Okay, if any of you are in college, this is a message for you. Modern Love is hosting another college essay contest this year. Modern Love editors want to know, what is love like for college students right now? Check out the show notes for more details. Okay, here we go. I want to call some people.
Hello?
Hi, Will.
Hi, Anna.
Where are you right
now?
Oh,
my God. Okay, I am in line to get on a ferry to go pick up my new cat.
That's exactly how I wanted to catch you, actually, so this is perfect. From the New York Times, this is the Modern Love Podcast. I'm Anna Martin, and these are my friends.
Sitting at my window, looking outside, listening to Adele.
I am in my apartment in Los Angeles, California.
I am in Florida.
Oh, I'm at the hospital. I'm on a 24-hour call in the pediatric ICU.
Got back to Mel's studio.
Yeah, you painting today?
You know it.
I have a question for you.
Yeah, for sure.
I'm talking to our friends about deal breakers. Do you have a deal breaker when it comes to dating?
I think my deal breaker is that I need to date someone that asks me a lot of questions, mm-hmm. like about my life or my thoughts. And like, here's the thing where it always comes a problem. Genuinely wants to hear my answers. I feel like that's such a big part of dating, is like getting to know someone else's world. And also like experiencing new things together, and someone who isn't interested in any of that, I just know it's not going to work out.
I'm going to call some other people.
Oh, I've got some. Let's see.
Deal breakers are things that you personally don't want in a partner. Like, it's not mean per se, it's just, it's personal.
That's true.
I'm someone who really loves to split entrees and like share apps, and when that doesn't happen, I'm just like, I don't know if you'll get me, because I don't know if you understand this part that's inherent to my culture.
So it's like, if they don't split the nachos.
Queso closed.
Queso closed.
Very often, like, people I'm meeting are like trying to make it in music or like film or something creative. And if it's like really bad.
You mean like if the thing that they're trying to do, like exactly. If their song is bad.
Exactly. Like their new single is like really not for me. Like, on the one hand, I root for you from afar, but like, I don't think I could be your girlfriend and like fake it and like go to your show and be like, I love this song, you know? So it's like, as much as I root for them, I think it is a deal breaker.
Mm-hmm. Chase your dreams, but do it with someone else.
Yep.
Hey, Will, with that, I'm going to let you catch your ferry. Send me a picture of the cat when you get it, okay?
Will do.
I love you.
Okay. Love you. Bye.
Bye.
Love now and
did you fall in love last time?
I love her.
Love was stronger than anything.
For the love.
And I love you more than anything.
There's still love.
A deal breaker is a tipping point. It's not about attraction or desire or even love. It's saying if we can't work this one thing out, we just can't be together. The essay on today's show comes from a woman doing that work, who fell in love despite her very big deal breaker. It's called Stand By Your Marlboro Man, written by Hyla Sabison Finn and read by January Lavoy.
"That's your husband?" the woman asked. I nodded. Together, we watched Larry, alone on a snow-covered porch, puffing away on a cigarette, while the party went on inside. "I'd never date a smoker," she said, "much less marry one." "I didn't marry one," I said. "Larry quit before the wedding." I declined to mention that "before" meant the day of, and that "quit" actually meant refrained from until he had so sullied our honeymoon with his grumpy behavior that I almost wished he'd start again. "Still, he smokes now," she said. "For me, it's a deal breaker." Did she think it had never occurred to me that I should have a rule against smoking? I was indoctrinated by parents whose cocktail parties were littered with no smoking signs back when smokers still mingled freely in society. I hated smoking. I wanted to ask her, how can you so casually dismiss someone you might love just because of one annoying habit? Was it Larry's fault he started smoking at 16 and couldn't seem to stop despite a record-setting number of attempts? Desperate to escape, I excused myself. Make him quit, she called after me. I first met Larry in our college library, where smoking was not permitted. By the time our paths crossed again outside the library, I was already smitten. He pulled out a pack of cigarettes. It was a miracle I was able to croak out a disbelieving, "You smoke?" I imagined my parents' reaction to the news that their 17-year-old daughter was involved not just with an older man, Larry was 21, a law student, but one who smoked. "Yes, but I'm quitting," he answered, inhaling deeply on his Marlboro. How long could it take, I wondered. 2 weeks? A month? A year later, we were still together. Me, Larry, and the cigarettes. The Larry and me part was great. The cigarettes, not so good. I found myself alone in restaurants while Larry stepped out. I got cold when he put down the top of his Jeep because we needed the air circulation. And I was afraid for my life as his cigarettes dangled precariously near flammable materials. Yet I was so in love that I was unable, that first year, to protest anything he did. But when he forgot my birthday and still remembered to buy a new lighter, I gathered my nerve and blurted out, "Do you remember what you said when we first met?" "Nope." "That you'd quit smoking."
"I did."
"Yes. So will you?"
"Sure."
When?
"How about when we drive to Florida next week?"
Goodbye cigarettes, but hello withdrawal symptoms on our 20-hour road trip to Miami. And in Miami, after making the excruciating rounds of his disjointed family, I had new insight into Larry's psyche and a new desire to shove a cigarette into his mouth. Not that he needed any encouragement. Back at school, with torts to study, video games to play, and socks to pair, turning over a new leaf was not a priority. But once law school ended, Larry was determined to quit, and he did. Picking him up from his new job as a law clerk for a federal judge, I was proud of my smoke-free, young, professional boyfriend. Then one day, something seemed askew. "Larry, you smell so minty," I said, leaning over for a kiss.
"The dentist told me to clean my teeth more often, so I'm keeping a toothbrush in my briefcase."
Many wintergreen kisses later, I found a cigarette butt floating in the toilet. "Don't you care about yourself?" I cried. "Or me?" He claimed he did, and signed up for a smoking cessation class. "How'd it go?" I asked when he returned in my breeziest voice.
"The people in my class are a mess. They elected me their unofficial group leader. Trust me, smoking is the least of their problems."
So much for the class, or any cessation. But I kept on it. I researched hypnosis and acupuncture. I bought books, tapes, and videos. All failed. Then Larry proposed, and he promised to quit before we were married. And again, he quit. Back from our honeymoon, he was industrious on other fronts, too, embracing more than his share of daily errands. Nothing was too small, large, or inconvenient for Larry to procure. Low on napkins during a season finale? Larry was out the door. Craving ice cream at 2 a.m.? No problem. Need shampoo during a snowstorm? Be right back. Soon, I smelled trouble, or more precisely, smoke, upon Larry's return from errands. Devastated, I couldn't fathom that I'd legally entangled myself with a man who would run to the store under false pretenses. What would it take to motivate him? What, as my parents regularly asked, was wrong with him? The truth is that Larry was completely supportive. When I wanted to move closer to my parents, he agreed. When I wanted to start a business, he said, "Go for it." Why couldn't I accept him as he accepted me, flaws and all? I tried, but the smoking always got in the way. "I don't think he's ever going to quit," I wailed to my sister. "No one thinks he's ever going to quit." But he started taking a prescription drug that helps smokers kick the habit. Despite nightmares, profuse sweating, and an inability to think clearly, he stuck with the medication. Several months later, we went out to dinner with another couple. "I'm sorry Larry's smoking again," my friend Jen said. "Dave is too." "Oh, no," I said. "Larry quit months ago." "I thought I saw him smoking on his way to the train the other day." Could it be true? Later, I confronted Larry. "Tell me the truth. I won't be mad. Did you start again?"
"No, Hyla," he said,
looking me straight in the eye. A week later, I found cigarettes hidden in his dusty gym bag. That evening, for the first time, I slept in another room. Smoking was one thing, but lying right to my face was another. This was no longer only about an annoying and unhealthy habit. It was about trust. If he could lie so easily about smoking, what would stop him from lying again about something else? I actually considered leaving, but where would I go? Move in with my parents? It seemed absurd. Later that night, Larry crawled in beside me and whispered,
"I'm so sorry. I didn't want to disappoint you."
I kissed him, trying not to notice the smell of smoke on his breath or calculate the years we had left together. I knew I would never leave. Instead, I decided I would quit. My nagging, I mean. And so I was shocked but silent when, without any urging, Larry, on a rotating cocktail of prescription drugs, the patch, and nicotine gum, finally did it. A month went by. Then three. I was cautiously optimistic. The patch disappeared. Then the pills. I felt hopeful. The gum lingered for an eternity, constantly being chomped, chewed, or parked in his mouth. Then, one day, it was gone. Larry was officially a non-smoker. A socially acceptable mate. It had only taken 17 years.
Hyla wrote this essay in 2005, so a lot has changed since then. After the break, I catch up with her and Larry. Hello.
Hi there.
Hi there.
Well, I'm happy to meet both of you, but Larry, I'm particularly excited to talk to you. So I'd love to start with you. Are you still smoke-free?
I've been smoke-free since,
whatever that last paragraph was that Hyla wrote about me using all available nuclear options to stop.
I'd love to go back to that moment, though, when you quit, because this essay, I mean, it's written from Hyla's point of view, and it does end with that sort of surprise final paragraph where you seemingly, out of the blue, decide to quit, and it sticks. And I want to go back to that time and ask you, why do you think that time worked when all the others didn't?
Just doing one thing to me was not going to enable me to stop doing what my normal habits were. So for me, it was a matter of kind of changing all of my habits. And so I combined, essentially, eating well, exercising every day. And so it ended up being something that I really took to heart.
So it sounds like you did this for yourself. I mean, did you do this for Hyla too, or did you need to come to it purely on your own?
Purely on my own.
That feels like a pregnant sigh. What's behind that sigh?
All the cajoling, all of the guilt, all of the pleading, all of that. It just doesn't move me.
Hyla, how does it feel to hear Larry say that?
It's so true. And to this day, it's so hard to like accept, because people always say, you know, you can't change other people. And I always just thought, well, that's so pessimistic. That's like, what a negative thought. Like,
well, these people haven't met me.
Right. Without hope, what is there, right? Because the tendency is to say, well, if they loved me enough, then they would do this for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't understand that it truly was an addiction, that it wasn't just like a choice, oh, I can just stop doing it. It took a long time to really understand that it was at that level.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's you know, a lot of this essay takes place in the first couple years of your relationship, at least in the early stage of your relationship, right? And you've now been married for how long?
I think it's going on 35.
We're in the 35th year.
Wow.
Yes.
Wow. And I guess I'm wondering, do y'all now have different ways of handling tension between the two of you? Or did this dynamic of, you know, you cajoling, as Larry said, and Larry suggesting, has that dynamic changed over the years?
It's probably lessened some. You know, I can tell you, 35 years with another person, I've never spent that much time, and she with anyone else either. And, you know, I we're probably similar to who we were then. Not identical, but similar. And probably with respect to interacting with one another, we probably have lessened some of the behaviors less often, less emotion maybe, because we've been through all of the experiences in communicating with each other. So you refine that communication over time is really what it is.
This has been such a treat to talk to both of you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, it was great. Appreciate it.
Our show is produced by Julia Botero and Hans Buto. It's edited by Sarah Saracen. This episode was mixed by Elisheba Itoop. Dan Powell created our Modern Love theme music. The original music in this episode is by Marion Lozano. Digital production by Mahima Chablani and Des Ibiqua. And a special thanks to Ryan Wegner at Autumn. And thanks to my wonderful friends, Aaron Edwards, Claire Bartholomew, Mira Dalal, Annabelle Newport, Ange Zitzi Zhang, Dora Grossman-Weir, Rhonda Sakala, Harry Krinsky, Dave Zimmerman, Abby Sessions, Raquel Ledesma-Haight, Shruti Gajaran, Will Sano, and his new cat, Mia. Modern Love was founded by Dan Jones. Mia Lee is the editor of Modern Love Projects. I'm Anna Martin. Thanks for listening.